I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to The Connection. Ada Ferrer was just 10 months old when she and her mother migrated from Cuba to the U.S., leaving her brother Poli behind. This was 1963, a few years after the revolution. Her parents ended up settling in America, and Ferrer went on to become a leading authority on Cuban history. In 2022, her book, Cuba and American History, won the Pulitzer Prize. Her new memoir, Keeper of My Kin, is based on the many personal letters and documents her parents had saved over the years. She tells a poignant and painful story about a family broken and made by historical events. Poli's life is scarred by the trauma of feeling abandoned by his mother. When he comes to the U.S. in 1980 on the Mariel boat lift, he's a troubled adult with a history of violence, mental illness, and addiction. Ada Ferrer joins us on The Connection today to talk about how history and family collide, the impact of immigration, family stories and secrets, being the chosen child, and why she writes, quote, to make amends. She's a professor of history at Princeton University. Ada Ferrer, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thanks for having me on, Marty.
You're very welcome. And thanks for writing this book. I have to say it's really stayed with me, and there's so much that I do want to talk with you about. I'd love to have you begin with the very first paragraph of the prologue, page one. Yeah, page one.
My mother always loved to hold me in her arms. When I was a young girl, or decades later, when I myself was already a mother. And even after that, when I was in my 50s and helping to care for her as she lay dying, she used to put her arm around my shoulder to put my head in close. Or she'd take my hand in hers and bring it to her lips. Then she'd look at me and say always the same thing. Como pasamos trabajo, tú y yo. How we struggled. You and I.
Your book begins, you're 10 months old. Your mother is leaving Cuba, the first in her family to leave the island to come to America, where her husband, your dad, is living. And there's a little detail that really stayed with me in that she wore high heels. And I always think, you know, if you're going to leave a country and maybe never come back, you're probably going to wear flat shoes or sneakers.
My mother, she always loved nice things, you know, and she loved high heels, and she loved what, you know, new look skirts, the full pleated skirts with pockets that were already going out of fashion then, but she loved them, and she sewed her own, and it was a momentous occasion, so she dressed for it, and she hoped she would come back.
Yes, your father had left earlier, and the way you write about him, he really hated Castro and was in many ways a critic of the revolution. Is that what brought him to the United States?
Yeah, he was always skeptical from the beginning that Castro was a communist. You know, Castro's revolution before it came to power was not avowedly socialist or communist. It became that in the first couple of years, but he suspected that from the start, and he was someone who was very, very vehemently anti-communist. And so he decided to leave after 1961, in the lead up to the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was when the U.S. invaded or tried to invade with using exile pilots and soldiers in April of 1961. And Castro basically said, on the eve of that invasion, said to the Cuban people that they should detain anyone who they believed might support an invasion when it arrived. And so someone denounced my father, and he was arrested or detained in a movie theater. Wow. It later became the Karl Marx movie theater. And he was detained there for about a week, and that kind of sealed his decision to leave. He didn't feel safe. He wanted to go. And so he went first, assuming that he would bring the rest of the family in short order.
You mentioned this earlier, but how much did your family think, well, once Castro is gone, we will go back to Cuba?
Yeah, that was always there were two assumptions, and they felt sure that one or the other would happen, but they weren't sure which would happen first. One is that the revolution would not survive that much longer, that the US would probably invade again, and that when it did, it would be better planned than the Bay of Pigs, and so that that would topple the government. So that was one assumption. And then the other assumption was much more personal and familial, and that is that the reason my mother left behind Boli, her son, was that his father would not let him leave. And my mother and the whole family believed that once we were gone, Boli's father would relent and he would join us.
And Boli's father was a supporter of Castro. But as you write, it almost felt like he was getting some revenge on your mother by keeping her son back.
Right. Yeah, he was a member of the Revolutionary Police, so he thought it wouldn't reflect well on him to have his son leave for the United States. That was one thing. The other thing is, I think he was just kind of a vindictive man and didn't want my mother to be happy. And so he never gave permission for Boli to join us. But then neither did he actually care for Boli after we left. So he kind of neglected him, didn't pay child support, didn't see him very much. Sad story.
Yeah, and I do want to get more to Boli, but there's something that you write about how Cuba permeated everything, and then you talk about an absent presence, a present absence. And I want you to flesh that out for us. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So I grew up mostly in a town called West New York, which is right across the Hudson River from New York City in New Jersey. And it was a small working class town, very densely populated, mostly with people born in Cuba. And so it was a Cuban American enclave. And, you know, it was a lot like what we think of as, you know, what we think of when we think of Miami, right?
Sure.
A Cuban American community. But this one was more uniformly working class, also a lot colder because it's in the north, a lot grayer, a lot uglier, to be frank, but compared to beautiful tropical Miami. But everyone spoke Spanish. The priest at church every Sunday prayed for the release of political prisoners. There was anti-Castro graffiti on the walls. Many of the people who ended up in West New York were people who came in the late 60s, early 70s. Some of them had small businesses in Cuba, which were confiscated in 1968 by the government. And so they eventually started those businesses there. So it was just this, you know, this place where Cuba was always being spoken about, always being remembered, but also never there, also really glaringly absent.
I mean, there must have been, you must have felt, and other Cubans living in America felt a kind of longing to either go home or to be with the people they had left behind.
Yeah. I think especially for people of my parents' generation, that marked every day of life in the U.S., right? They had left people behind. They had left their country behind. They had left their language behind. And so, yeah, so there was a lot of nostalgia, a lot of longing. I think for my generation, it was more complicated because some of us didn't have those memories or those, you know, or didn't live there for that long. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you're growing up in the U.S. and you're watching American TV and you kind of are resenting your parents' insistence on this other world.
You mentioned the fact that your brother Boli was left behind. He was about 8 or 8 and a half, I guess, when you and your mother left Cuba. But one thing that your mother omitted was that she left the country without telling Boli. As you write, left behind his back.
Yeah.
Do you know why she didn't tell her son she was leaving?
Yeah. So, you know, I knew about Boli my whole life. There were pictures of him. We wrote to him. I used to kiss his picture. He was always present in that way. But I was older. I don't quite remember when I learned that fact that my mother left without saying goodbye. It might have been a teenager. I might have been in my 20s. It was around there somewhere. And what my mother always said, and then after I started going to Cuba and met my mother's sister, my aunt Ada, both has same name as me, though we called her Tia Niña, what What they both said was that he wouldn't be able to handle it, and my mother wouldn't be able to handle it, that there would be a horrible scene, that he would start crying, that he would, hold on to her, and that she wouldn't be able to leave. And so, in consultation with her own mother and her sisters, they decided that the kindest thing to do was to leave, and then to have my grandmother and my aunts explain our departure later. And it's something that, it's something when I first learned it, it shocked me and it hurt me and it puzzled, it puzzled me. But I felt like in the memoir, I had to confront it. I couldn't just, shoo it away or, sweep it under the rug, that I had to face it head on. And it's complicated because
Sure.
it's something that my mother did, right? That she did to my brother. But it's also something that, something as a mother that is hard for me to understand, but it's also, I know, very hard to put yourself in the position of another person in another place, in another time. And, people make decisions necessarily only with the information in front of them. They don't know what's coming next. So she really assumed that they would soon be reunited.
And I wonder too whether the fact that she sort of kept this secret or didn't tell other people was the kind of guilt that she must have felt as a mother, leaving a child behind, or even the shame of a decision like that, just to put it out of your, just to put it in a box somewhere so you don't have to think about it or feel it.
Although I think she never succeeded in putting it in a box, and she thought and felt that guilt all her life. I also want to say that what she did, it wasn't the norm, but it was also more common than we would think. And I learned recently there's a Cuban dissident in prison in Cuba, a rapper named Michael Osorbo, and I learned recently that when his mother left him, I think he was about 12, I can't quite remember, maybe a little older, his mother left without saying goodbye. I think it's a decision that people make for the moment, thinking that they will be able to make amends and fix it in some way after.
Yeah, we're almost up on a break here. And the thought that your parents had that we will hopefully or probably go back to Cuba and then maybe get reunited. Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Ada Ferrer is our guest today on The Connection. She's a professor of history at Princeton University. In fact, she is one of the leading authorities on Cuba, a country where she was born and left when she was just 10 months old. She's got a brand new book, a memoir titled Keeper of My Kin, Memoir of an Immigrant Daughter. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoeng talking with Ada Ferrer about her new book, a memoir titled Keeper of My Kin. Your brother Poli did write letters, really poignant, painful letters to your mother, his mother, when he was in Cuba and you were in the States. And I'll just quote a couple of lines. He writes, "If you only knew how much I miss you all. I want you to send me something because I'm sad. I've been missing you all these days." And then one that just is such a heartbreak. "When a letter arrives from there, obviously from your mom, I get so happy that sometimes it makes me sad." And as a, a daughter, a sister, and you said it's excruciating for you to read those letters and to have discovered them and to start reading them.
Yeah, so I didn't know the letters existed. I knew they had written to each other, but I didn't know my mother had saved them. I found them after both my parents had died. She had saved them high up, on a shelf in the closet, and she had left them all in their envelopes, and they were in order, and then they were all tied together with gold curling ribbon. And the first one I opened was the very first letter he wrote to her, which he wrote less than a week after we left. And so the letters are excruciating. They change over time. In the beginning, he's a little boy asking for gifts and, talking about little boy things. And as he gets older, he's talking about other things, beer and rum and talking really intensely and almost disturbingly about how much he wants to be with our mother. So yeah, they were excruciating to read. They were also, I think, a gift for me. I think having them, it's a chronicle of his life, his coming of age. I say in the book, the paper remains of something that should never have happened.
And he wanted gifts. I mean, in certain ways, why wouldn't he, right? But a gift is also a kind of a, it can be a tangible example of a mother's love for her child to get him something special.
Yeah, and she did that her whole life. She was always sending things, calling him, writing, and then even after he arrived in the US as a troubled young man, she never gave up on him, even when he ended up doing really awful things to her and to other members of the family. She stood by him, and towards the end of her life, she kept saying, "I believe in him, I believe in him."
He writes at one point, "Deep inside me lives the name of my absent mother." And again, I mean, in certain ways, it's profoundly beautiful and psychologically astute, but at the same time, to feel that and to have written that is just so painful.
And reading the letters, finding the letters, reading them, really grappling with them was probably the hardest part of doing this book. They were excruciating to read. I could only read them in short spurts, but they also allowed me to understand my brother in a way I never had before, and to understand my mother because she read them. And she felt, and she felt what they made her feel. And I can imagine that much better now than I had before.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from the book. This is on page 130, where Polly writes you a little poem on the back of a postcard. It begins in, he obviously writes in Spanish, and then you translate it for us readers. Could you read both the Spanish and the English?
Sure. So it's a poem on the back of a postcard, and it goes like this. And he wrote it, he composed it.
Right.
Nada soy, nada reclamo, nada tengo, nada espero, sino el limpio desespero de mi amor por lo que amo. I am nothing, I demand nothing, I have nothing, I expect nothing, but the pure desperation of my love for what I love.
So he wrote that to you. How did you take that when you saw that
I don't
postcard?
remember.
You don't
I
remember.
don't remember.
I
I mean,
mean,
I found the postcard among my own papers towards the end of writing this book. It wasn't even in the first draft. So I think I would have been puzzled by it. I wouldn't have known what it meant. I would have been reading it out of context because my mother shared some of his letters with us, but she wouldn't have shared those really intense things he said about her. So to me, I think I would have been a little puzzled. I wouldn't have understood, and I think I might have felt a little guilty, which I did all my life in relation to him. But that he has nothing, he expects nothing, and my whole life I had my mother.
In fact, your book is so much about Poli and what happened to him, but also what happened to you. This almost parallel tracks of your lives. Obviously, you end up at Vassar College. He makes it through fifth grade, I think, in school in Cuba. Obviously, he's a very troubled young man, or becomes a very troubled young man. And you talk about the penance of being the chosen one. And obviously, that's a huge burden for a young person, but it so permeates this memoir that you've written. What does that mean, the penance of the chosen one?
Yeah, I mean, I did always feel like the chosen one. And I think that feeling probably became more intense and more complicated after after Bully arrived in the US and I saw who he was and how he was and how we had become very different people as a result of my mother's decision. And so I always had that guilt. I thought, I don't think I used this word in the book, but I remember thinking about it in these terms pretty early in, in my young adulthood, thinking about it as my original sin
Wow.
that my mother brought me and left him. So at the very start of my life and my success here and my life here was the fact that my brother was left behind. So, and so I do think that I became interested in Cuba to understand all of it, to understand why my parents left, why so many other members of the family didn't leave, what it meant for Bully to grow up there, and even to think about what might have happened if I had grown up there, right? I
Sure.
always used to think about what if. So I do think that I felt this profound guilt over our kind of our family story. And I do think that I became a historian of Cuba, that I began writing about Cuba in part to make amends. I also think, and I say this also in the book, that becoming a historian, becoming a scholar, getting a BA and then an MA and a PhD took me into worlds radically different than my parents, right? They both came from rural Cuba. They had sixth grade educations. My education here catapulted me to a completely different world. But I think I never wanted to leave them behind. And so I think studying Cuba was a way of kind of advancing, making my way in the world, doing something special, but bringing them with me the whole time. It was a way to keep thinking about them and keep them present.
But did you feel that somehow your success was connected to Poli's suffering? That the fact that you have done so well and he did so poorly or had so many problems in life, that they were related somehow?
I think I did, even though probably intellectually, or logically, it doesn't make, 100% of sense, but we don't always think that way and we don't feel that
No.
way. We don't feel always with logic at the forefront of
No.
of our thinking. So yes, I always did feel, or I began to feel, I think especially in my 20s, that yeah, that I was doing this amazing thing and that I was doing it because I had been brought here. And I even used to think, what if he had come with us? What would have happened? And there's a scenario in which everything would have been okay.
Yeah.
And there's a scenario in which he still would have been a very troubled young man with a penchant for getting in trouble and doing illegal things. And maybe he would have dragged us all down with him, right? So I don't know what would have happened. So I did think about things like that. And then when I started going to Cuba, as a Cuban American, as someone who had family there and wanted someone who had been born there and wanted to know it, but also as a scholar, it meant that I could move in Cuba and be in Cuba in ways that he had never been able to, right? That I had privileges even in Cuba that he never got to have.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Ada Ferrer, our guest today on The Connection. She's a professor of history at Princeton University, has written a number of books about Cuba. Her new book is a memoir, and it's titled Keeper of My Kin, Memoir of an Immigrant Daughter. It's about leaving Cuba when she was a very young child, really a baby, and a brother that her mother left behind, and the impact that it had on the family. Your brother came over on the Mariel boat lift. I remember that, little point in Cuban American history where something like 10,000 Cubans were actually allowed to
Oh.
more.
Oh, no, go ahead. I interrupted
No,
you.
that's
Sorry.
okay, but something like 10,000 Cubans were allowed to come to America.
Actually, it was 125,000
There
by
you
the end
go.
of
Okay, 125,000, a lot more than 10,000.
it. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
so a massive migration
Massive.
allowed to come to the United States. And he was one of them. Came to Florida, came to Miami. And you describe meeting him for the first time. And what did you see, or who did you see?
Well, he wasn't what I expected. I think I had grown up in the US my whole life. English, I was always bilingual, but I think by then because all my schooling was in English. Excuse me. English had become my dominant language. I watched American TV, American sitcoms. I thought he would be like my cute older brother, like Greg Brady and the Brady Bunch or something. And what encountered me was, I mean, what I encountered in meeting him was, a 26-year-old man who always seemed angry to me. He spoke loudly, he spoke gruffly. He just wasn't what I expected.
There were incidents of violence, and at one point you write, I think in your diary, I hate him. I mean, his presence must have disrupted the family, even though, of course, the fantasy was to be united as a family.
Yeah, he arrived in 1980. I was about to leave for college. It was the summer, right when I graduated from high school, and I was about to leave. So, it just again, it was like this mo you know, there had been this moment in 1963 where our lives took these radically different turns because of my mother's decision. And then he arrives in 1980, and again, our lives are going to take radically different turns because I'm about to go off to Vassar, right? And he's arrives in the U.S. and almost immediately, not in the first months, but by a year in, he's already getting in trouble, having trouble holding down a job, drinking too much, and that the summer after my freshman year of college, he assaulted me and tried to beat me up. Luckily, a cousin was there and stopped him. So, yeah, so there was violence, and I grew to be really afraid of him,
Was your
which is
mo
terrible.
Yes, indeed. Was your mother afraid of him?
Yes. Yes. She had such guilt, and she always felt that he was the way he was because of her. And she said that in 2014, already like in her, she was almost 90, she wrote a letter for what we should do after she died. And she said, "Take care of Bully. He is the way he is because of me."
Oh, well.
So she always felt that guilt. She did always have that fear. But, it's interesting. Late in life, he did soften quite a bit. He was raised in Cuba by my grandmother, who died in the mid 70s, and then by my mother's youngest sister, who has the same name I do, Ada. And after she died in 2017, something changed for Boley. I think he realized that my mother was all he had left and that she wouldn't be around much longer. And that kind of changed him and softened him, and they were their relationship became a lot less volatile those last years. So she also said over and over again, "I believe in him. He will never hurt us. I believe in him. He's changed. He's good."
You say that, that you had thought about sort of asking Polly about his life to sort of get to know him better, but you didn't. You said you were afraid. Were you afraid to, was it part of that chosen child feeling that you had to know more about his life, but that this was sort of a fantasy conversation that you have, but it never really happened. How come?
I was afraid. I was always, he to me always seemed unpredictable and volatile and potentially violent. And I didn't know how he would take my questions. I didn't know how feeling those emotions, how bringing them to the fore for him, what that would be like for him and how he would respond. So I'd never had that conversation with him.
I mean, I think in all families there are those either those conversations or those that information that you just don't go there
Right.
because you're a family and it just feels like you're gonna upset the apple cart, so to speak,
Right.
by digging into something that just seems really fraught.
Right. And I think that's what happened, yeah.
One of the things that Polly does say, I guess, to your mother, "You never ask for my forgiveness," which again is this really touching, sad, profound thing to say. Do you think if she had, would that have changed? I mean, this is a what if, so who knows, right? But
Right.
if
Well,
But what was that about? No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I mean, I think in her own way, she had asked for forgiveness, but she hadn't asked for forgiveness in the way he wanted to hear it. There's a truck outside. Am I okay?
No, you're fine. You're fine.
Okay. Yeah, she had basically, I think the way she asked for forgiveness was to say something like, if I had known what my leaving would do to you, I would have never left.
Right.
I would have never done this to you, which is different than a full-on apology, right? That that it wasn't just about how he reacted, but it was about leaving him, which I think is the apology he wanted. So I think in some ways, there was a little bit of a misencounter there. I think he was so angry and so bent on not forgiving her.
Yeah.
That I don't know how much more she could have done, because she did do so much after having left him.
Right. We're almost at our second break here, but do you think sort of hurt and anger, being hurt and feeling angry, that they go hand in hand for your brother?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He was, yeah, there was so much pain there and so much anger there. And of course, those are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. Yeah. And just very briefly, and was your father sort of more on the, it wasn't his biological, he had another son who was back in Cuba, but very different story. Was he sort of on the sidelines? And I'm sorry to make you rush through the answer.
I think a little bit. I think my mother didn't tell him everything that was happening with Poli. So he didn't realize some of the threats and some of the things that had happened. And yeah, so my mother was always, you know, wanting to, I mean, this is a longer story,
sure.
But my mother was always fearful. My mother loved my father. He was so handsome and beautiful.
Yes.
And she didn't want him to leave. And she was scared Poli might make him leave. So she didn't tell him everything.
That's Ada Ferrer, our guest today on The Connection. She's got a new book, Keeper of My Kin. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Just to recap here, in 1963, when she was just a tiny baby, Ada Ferrer migrated from Cuba to the U.S. with her mother, leaving an older brother behind. Her new memoir, Keeper of My Kin, is about piecing together her family's history, shaped by loss, love, and geopolitics. I should add that she is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. Just to kind of complete this particular story, I mean, Poli died, your parents died as well. And I wonder, did you wait for all of that to write this memoir, sort of knowing that you could sort of mine all this family history without knowing that they're alive and maybe might read it?
Yeah. Well, they would have, none of them would have been able to read it in English, but, right. You know, and I think my parents always suspected that I would be writing something about this. I think that is part of what the saving all the letters and the artifacts and things was about. But I could never have written it with my brother still alive.
Yeah.
I couldn't have had done these interviews. I couldn't have spoken as frankly about it. And I think it would have triggered him. I don't know what would have happened, so I wouldn't have dared to.
You know, I mean, this is your story, and I don't want to take anything away from that, but because we are learning about migrant or immigrant families separating from children and leaving others behind, this sort of this absence presence that you've been talking about, I feel, is very relevant, and I'm sure that there are families who are experiencing their version of what you are talking about. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wrote it out of a personal need, but then as I was revising it after Trump was elected a second time and the immigration crackdown started, I couldn't help but think about that, because a lot of times the way politicians talk about, and certainly the way about Republicans mostly talk about immigration is, they demonize immigrants. They're all criminals. They're rapists. They separate children and parents without, I think, almost without a second thought. And then I think about stories like ours, which are so common. So many immigrant families have some version of this story of leaving, thinking that the separation won't last, of longing for people left behind, of working really, really hard to give children opportunities. And I just wanted to provide part of what the book does, I think, is provide a really human portrait of immigration and of immigrant families who are basically just trying to get by and live and love each other and be here.
Yeah. But what's so interesting, because you are a historian, a Pulitzer Prize winning historian at that, is, your parents lived through so much history in Cuba, yet in certain ways, while they were affected by it, they didn't have a television, so they couldn't see Castro. There was so much that they didn't see that actually didn't
Right.
affect them. And yes, and yet of course it affected them immensely.
Right. And I think that is really, sh I mean, I think that fact shapes so much of what I do as a historian and all my work, right? This idea that there's big history, right? There's geopolitical decisions and big historical events, and they reverberate in individual lives. But sometimes the people living those lives don't even realize at the time,
Yeah.
right? So there are many, my parents were utterly ordinary people. So they didn't go to rallies. They didn't participate in these big historical events. But there's no way to understand their lives without understanding the sway of history, the influence of history on
I think you referenced this earlier, that in a sense you became a
it.
historian to understand your family. I mean, their family letters, memory, which can be a little fuzzy, their documents, their archives for historians to rummage through to understand a country or maybe a piece of history. But it's interesting how these sort of parallel research projects emanate from you.
Yes, exactly. I think I was always interested in the ways in which history writ large doesn't always connect with intimate histories in the family. They're completely connected, but there's all these kind of it's so much messier than we think of when we think of history in the abstract. And so much more, it's so much messier, so much more complicated, so much more like literature, actually. Yeah.
We've talked a lot about your mom, but your dad, later in life, sounds like he became a writer in a certain kind of way, and he wrote lots of letters to presidents, to Castro, and to other, I guess, people in power. And I'd love to have you, it's on page 247. I'd love to have you read a letter that he wrote to Castro. He makes a notation at the bottom that he never, or it says not sent, but I think it speaks to, tells us something about your dad. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. So the letter is dated April 19th, 1993, and that's the first letter he wrote to Fidel Castro. And he writes, this is from its last paragraph. How is it possible that a man like you, of your intelligence, who once counted on the support of the people of Cuba and had the courage to say before 500,000 of his compatriots, here we are communists, can still be determined after more than 3 decades of continual failures in almost every aspect of life in Cuba to continue pursuing mistaken and unjust policies for his people. Mr. Castro, enough already with so much deception for the Cuban people. With the same valor with which you aligned your country to the communist bloc, leave it free now of a system that holds no future for our beautiful island. And once more, take up the cause of freedom and progress.
Your dad's a beautiful writer.
Yeah. It's interesting. Again, he had a sixth grade education, but in his 70s, he just began to write, and he wrote all the time. And he wrote these letters to political figures, he wrote to media figures, he wrote poems, he wrote autobiography. And then the main thing he wrote was letters to the son that he had also left behind, that I didn't learn about until I was in my 20s. And those letters, the letters between the two of them, are just beautiful. They are like love letters, two grown men getting to know each other through old-fashioned letters.
Did he ever hear back from those people that he wrote to when he actually sent the letters?
From a few, I can't remember now which ones. He said he didn't, he told me he'd had never, that he didn't remember ever hearing back from Fidel Castro. And I certainly found no evidence of that in his papers.
He says to Castro and in some of his other letters, it's time, it's time.
Right. He keeps saying, it's time, it's time, it's time to leave the future of Cuba to young people. It's time to do this. It's time. But, you know, the letters start in 1993. I forget what. Oh, the last one, I think, is in 2006 when Fidel Castro gets sick. And, you know, that the time kept coming and passing and, you know, nothing happened.
There's a funny little you and your sister buy him a journal to keep a notation. I don't have it right at my fingertips, but basically he says, you know, here's this journal, but I actually don't want to write in it. I forget. It sort of dismisses the two of you, right?
Right, right. Especially because he used to love to write so much that then later after my mother died and he was just sitting around doing nothing, we tried to get him to write again, but he resisted.
You wrote a letter recently to the current president of Cuba, President Díaz-Canel, and I have it here. And as we know, I mean, there's this, it's not even a showdown. There's this, you know, strangulation, I would say, of Cuba going on even as we speak. You write to the president and you say, yes, you know, the embargo has hurt the Cuban people and all of that. But you also say Cuba's economic policies, its surveillance, its harassment of its critics is also to blame for the condition that Cuba is in today. Again, can you just how do you feel as you're watching this conflict unfold?
Well, I mean, I feel terrible. I still have a lot of friends and family in Cuba, and I'm in touch with them, and so I hear from them about going, you know, 5 days without electricity, of you know, one issue after another, with no sense of hope on, you know, on the horizon. And so I feel terrible about it, and I feel angry when I hear Donald Trump say he's going to do whatever he wants with Cuba. So awful. But I wrote the letter in part because I feel like, well, you know, I've been thinking about Cuba's been on my mind nonstop, basically, a lot of my life. But, you know, it's since January, since the attack on Maduro. And I've been trying to write something and not kind of finding the right register. And I was working on something and remembered my father's letters. And so I went back to them to find a quote. And all of a sudden, I had this idea, I'm going to write my own letter. And part of what I wanted to do was to be reasonable and rational. And I feel like there's two sides that are really polarized. And each side gives nothing and cannot recognize the truths in what the other side says. And so what I wanted to do was to write a letter that acknowledged all the complaints that the Cuban government makes against the U.S., and I agree with them 100%, but to also say, you know, that doesn't explain what's going on in Cuba. And what's going on in Cuba isn't just the last 5 months. It's been building for a long time. And you have to take responsibility for your own role, in your own huge role in the hardships that Cuba is going through. So I just wish more people were willing to do that, kind of sit down and recognize and see each other. I don't think we're going to get anywhere without that.
You had mentioned President Trump, and I do want to play just a very short clip. This was earlier this spring where he makes a comment about Cuba. I'll let him speak for himself, and then we can talk about it.
You know, all my life I've been hearing about the United States and Cuba. When will the United States do it? I do believe I'll be the honor of having the honor of taking Cuba. That'd be good. That's a big honor.
Taking Cuba.
Taking Cuba in some form, yeah. Taking Cuba. I mean, whether I free it, take it, I think I could do anything I want with it. You want to know the truth? They're a very weakened nation right now.
Do whatever I want with Cuba. Does that sound familiar as you look at Cuban-American history?
It sounds so familiar. I mean, my whole life I've studied Cuban history. My first book was on the Cuban Wars of Independence against Spain, which ended with U.S. intervention. So I've spent decades thinking about U.S.-Cuba relations, about U.S. imperial designs on the island. So yes, it sounds very familiar. Though I gotta say, you know, I can't think of any president, even 100 years ago, who spoke that crudely about Cuba in this way. That, you know, 100 years ago, the sentiment would have been similar, but the delivery might have been more eloquent and a little more discreet.
How do you think something like that plays out in Cuba itself?
Well, I think Cubans right now are mostly just really desperate for change. And so I think that desire is the most prominent for the greatest number of people. So I think there are some who are willing to countenance some kind of change that involves the U.S. But I do think that the language, the sentiment is, you know, offends a great many people.
You were in Cuba when President Obama went to Cuba and gave a speech. I mean, it feels like a, you know, another time, another place. But I'm trying to imagine what that meant for the Cuban people to have an American president on their soil.
It was huge. You know, I mean, I started going to Cuba in 1990. I've made maybe 30 trips, maybe a little more than that over many years. And that trip, March 2016, was one of the most exciting that I ever took. My parents were with me, which was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
My father's first trip back. But I have never sensed in Cuba the degree of hope that I sensed during Obama's visit. There was a sense that something was budging, that something was changing. But a very different moment than it is now, because it didn't feel ominous and terrifying in the way the current moment feels. It didn't feel like survival itself was something that wasn't guaranteed. I think that Obama's opening to Cuba was probably the greatest chance for a gradual, peaceful transition, and with the least amount of generalized suffering, which is what we're seeing now.
Yeah. I mean, you must have family, friends in Cuba now. How do they survive?
Well, it feels like people are barely surviving. You know, it's so hard to get food. People are living day to day. There's no water in a lot of places, because without electricity, it's impossible to pump water. And then the electricity, you know, I have family in these small towns in the interior, and two of them had just been 5 days without any electricity at all. So you can't keep food. Food is already so expensive, but how do you keep food on hand if there's no electricity, right? And then in Havana, they don't go that long without electricity. So what happens in Havana instead is that it comes on and off. Like it's mostly off, and then it'll come on for an hour. But you never know when it's coming. And so it might be in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden you get up and you have to charge everything. And it almost feels like this strange kind of psychological torture of everyone is just worried, when's it coming on? How long is it going to last? Do I plug something in now? Do I do it later? Are my electrical appliances going to last with all this on off, right? Or will they be, will they short circuit or something? So it just feels people can't sleep because, you know, you need a fan, you need, you know, forget AC. There's people who don't have AC, but they, you know, you can't even keep a fan going. So people aren't sleeping, they're sleep deprived. It just sounds horrible. And there's actually more and more protests that are happening. People, I mean, it's been going on for months, but I think the pace is picking up of people kind of banging on pots at night and now during the day as well.
Yeah. Well, I hate to leave it there because there's so much more to talk about. Ada Ferrer, thank you so much for writing this book and for joining us today on The Connection.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, the book is titled Keeper of My Kin, Memoir of an Immigrant Daughter. Ada Ferrer won the Pulitzer Prize for a previous book, Cuba and American History, and she is a professor of history at Princeton University. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen on the WHYY app. You can follow Connection on Instagram, and you can find the show on Facebook. Debbie Builder produces the show. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Again, thanks for listening.